Okay, our next and last talk for this afternoon by Bruce Harvnick is an observational study of evolving stars.
You can get just push the button once more and it'll get mine off there, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You can pull the tray up.
Yeah, pull this out.
Or we can just double click on it.
Close it and close it.
That's mine.
Oh, that's yours. Okay. Okay.
Here we go. Huh?
I don't know. I'll let you do that.
Okay. Well. Yeah, thank you very much. I'm going to, I'm at Valparaiso University, so it's an hour and a half drive from here. It's a pleasure to be here at Wheaton. I'm going to talk about a study of evolving stars. I'm an observational astronomer. Some of the work is carried out at Valparaiso University, but others of it takes place at large national universities or even from space. My wife says, you know, say a little bit personal, so here I am at that, and I think I'll be better for it. But I became a Christian when I was about 10 or 12 in that age range, went to a very good evangelical church, but was very private as a Christian. In graduate school, I finally met other Christians in the sciences. That was an encouragement to me. And about that time, so I've got this 40-year, about that time I became aware of ASA and joined that. And having those interactions and continuing to have them at Valparaiso has been an encouragement to me in my faith. And those of you who are young, I hope you take advantage of that soon and enjoy those benefits. Okay. Now, in the first half of the 20th century, a little bit of history in this, but not as much as in the last talk, astronomers were working hard to learn the properties of stars. We can get the luminosity from the apparent brightness, from the parallax of the stars, how we could measure how far away they are. The temperature of the stars came from their spectra. These are examples of the spectra of stars, you know, nice colorized versions. Spectral types, different letters were assigned to them based on the appearance of lines in the spectra, some of them due to hydrogen. We've got calcium down here. This is the H alpha and H beta. Other lines, but with the introduction of atomic physics, we were able to interpret the temperature of the stars, what temperatures would populate those energy levels. The other properties that we would like to know would be size, which we can get, particularly if one star passes in front of the other, and the mass of the stars, which requires that they be in binary pairs, and we can use laws of gravity. With these properties, then, we look for relationships between them. Around 1910 or so, Hertzsprung and Russell, working independently, made a graph the luminosity, the intrinsic brightness of the star against its temperature. I mean, they were using spectral class and different measures. Astronomers use a magnitude system. But it's luminosity. And one of the first things to note is that stars didn't fall just anywhere on this graph. If we did a volume-limited sample, we would find that 90% of them fall along what then was called the main sequence, from hot, intrinsically bright stars to cool, faint stars. Some stars that are cool, though, are intrinsically brighter. They must be larger giants, red giants, or even supergiant stars. And then some that were relatively hot but rather faint must be really small, white dwarfs. Now, in the 1930s, we learned about nuclear fusion and what was powering stars. And hydrogen fusing to helium was deduced to be the energy source for stars. But, you know, that can't go on forever. Eventually, the hydrogen is fused to helium. And along the way, the composition of the star is changing. And so its structure changes, and the star evolves. So here we're using evolution in a non-biological way. And so in the second half of the 20th century, one of the major accomplishments in stellar astronomy, talking about stars, is to learn how stars evolve, how they evolve or change their properties in such a diagram with time. And we find that stars like the Sun, which would reside somewhere around here on this diagram, they gradually expand and become cooler. And the details of that are shown on this diagram, next diagram here, which trace how stars' properties change, how their luminosity and temperature change with time. And if we connect the dots, we get what we call an evolutionary trend. And it depends on the mass of the star. Now, I don't want to go into this pretty busy diagram, but after the star finishes fusing hydrogen to helium in its core, our models of the structure of stars and how they change with time shows that they would expand to become red giant stars. Eventually, helium fusion begins in the core of the star. That requires a higher temperature than to fuse helium, than to fuse hydrogen. And stars then begin fusing helium to carbon, and the star settles down to another relatively long time period. The Sun, this might be 9 or 10 billion years, maybe a billion years here, fusing helium to carbon and some oxygen. And then when the carbon is exhausted, the core contracts. Fusion begins in shells around the core. The star expands again, gets larger and unstable. So it starts to pulsate, and we see these stars pulsating with periods on the order of years. And they lose their outer layers. It's thought that as they pulsate material, it's a complicated process. They lose their outer layers, revealing basically the core of the star with a little atmosphere. And we think those cores then, the models show that the core of the star evolves horizontally from cooler to higher temperatures at about constant luminosity. Meanwhile, the shell of ejected gas expands away, but when the star inside at its surface gets hot enough, about 30,000 degrees, it can photoionize the nebula, causing it to fluoresce, and we see it a very illuminated and beautiful planetary nebulae. So most of these phases, we observe stars here in the main sequence, red giant, these yellow supergiants, the second giant branch, and we observe the planetary nebulae. But what we don't observe, and of course white dwarfs, and let me just show you some of these phases. So here are the red giant and supergiant stars, such as Betelgeuse and the shoulder of Orion. This is the size of about the orbit of Jupiter around the Sun, so they get to be hundreds of times the size of our Sun. Here are planetary nebulae, and you can see the central star in this one. Some of them appear, this looks like a bubble, so they are rather spherical. Others appear to have rather interesting shapes. And then we also see white dwarfs. This is not the white dwarf. This is the bright star Sirius that you may be familiar with in the winter sky. Beside it is a star that orbits around it of rather similar temperature, but much, much less luminous because it's so much smaller. And that's a white dwarf about the size of the Earth. Well, back to this diagram, we observe almost all the phases except for this phase, when the star is evolving from the red giant, having lost its outer layers, but it's not yet hot enough to photoionize the gas. And so there's not much to bring attention to. And it turns out that this is a relatively short-lived phase, on the order of 1,000 years, short-lived astronomically speaking. So the discovery of these so-called protoplanetary nebulae, the stars at this sort of missing link in the evolution of stars, occurred only in the mid to late 1980s. Time period is short. I use the analogy with the human lifetime. It would represent about 17 minutes of an 85-year lifetime. So to catch the star in that that phase of it is not very likely, so we need to use some wisdom in how to select stars that might be in that phase. And it can be obscured by the gas and dust that it loses. So the project that I was involved with was then looking for these stars to identify them and study their properties. And basically, they're going to have properties between these two. And the particular thing I want to focus it on is that we know planetary nebulae have dust around them. They're detected in the infrared, and I'll tell you how that's an indication of dust in a moment. And that was the key to detecting these objects. Because as the gas moves out from the star and cool, it can condense into dust. The dust can absorb the light from the star inside and heat up and allow us to detect it by its infrared signal. So in 1983, NASA and the European Space Agency launched a satellite called IRAS that surveyed the entire sky. It wasn't pointing at specific objects of interest. As it went around, its detectors detected anything that gave infrared emission above a certain low limit, and it detected 250,000 sources. This was the largest star catalog of it at that time. And the fact that it not only had an infrared camera, but it had four filters that allowed one to determine approximately the temperature of the infrared emitting source. Now, some of them were just stars, and it's sort of the tail of the black body curve for stars. But for others, they were distinctly peaking in the mid-infrared, indicative of temperatures in the order of a few hundred degrees, about the temperature of dust around, the temperature of the Earth is about 300 Kelvin. So objects, the dust that was far removed from the central source, which is about what one would expect for stars in this transition. The dust is not so far away from them, but it would have a temperature of about a few hundred degrees. And I say providentially, I became involved in this. At that time, I was a postdoc at the University of Calgary. Stayed in God's providence for an extra 2 years for a second postdoc. Someone joined the faculty there, Sun Kwok, who was an expert on planetary nebulae. When this catalog came out, he invited me to do some observing with him, and then we just followed the trail of these. So that it's just been very good. So I'm thankful that I didn't leave early, and in God's providence, I ended up taking the job later at Valparaiso University. So that was all good. So we got time, we applied for time, and were awarded time at some of the big telescopes in Hawaii, the Canada-France-Hawaii Telescope, NASA Infrared Telescope, United Kingdom Infrared. Some of these others, like Keck, have been built subsequent to our first going out there. And we pointed to where the satellite said there was indicated there was a source, and in some cases, so that these lines indicate where the infrared source is. Now, this is visible light picture. The star is completely obscured by the dust, and we found a number of those. So it was pretty exciting when we saw a bright star right where the infrared signal was detected. Once we have a star, now we can start to learn the properties of that and see if this is indeed and has the properties of stars that we'd expect in this evolutionary phase. This is a spectrum of a star, identified some of the absorption lines by certain elements, but we can interpret it as the temperature. Now, the temperatures we're looking for are between 5,000 and 30,000, so this is within that range. And it had the luminosity. There's some subtle features that tell you it's not a main sequence star, but it's an intrinsically bright, big star. So that would this pass that hurdle. And this shows measurements. This is the flux received here at the Earth. This is wavelength. This is on a logarithmic scale. So this is visible light. This is the near infrared. This is the mid infrared. And these show what we call a double peak spectral energy distribution. We have one peak from the photosphere of the star reddened somewhat by the dust around it, and then a second peak out in the mid-infrared from the reabsorption and emission by dust. And then this was the key we found from the 250,000 sources on the order of 80 to 100 that looked like they would fit into the properties of having the right temperature dust. So we had telescope. We were fortunate to be awarded telescope time. We put it in Mauna Kea because it sticks above the clouds sometimes here. And it's very dry, mountaintop. So observations that we carried out in the late 80s and 90s, identifying a number of these objects. And then national observatories in Arizona and Chile measure the spectra, the brightness of visible wavelengths and things. Very interesting site and exciting research project. So from the studies, we've got the star inside that we can begin to learn the properties of, and we have the nebula around it. And I had the opportunity to be involved in really all of these things, learning about the chemistry of the gas and dust, about the shape of the nebula. And I'm going to talk about two things, the nebula around it and about variability of the central star. These objects, as I said, originated from red giant stars, which we believe to be basically spherical. And yet, in the planetary nebulae, they're quite interesting shapes. Some of them look rather spherical, but look at the patterns here, rather point symmetry in these. This is what we call bipolar butterfly. A lot of them have a bipolar symmetry. So where does that come from, and can we learn something from the transition phase of how that forms? So we were able to get time in Hawaii, again, on some of these big telescopes. The Canada-France-Hawaii telescope had a camera at that time that sort of jiggled a little bit to compensate for the Earth's atmosphere, so it gave about the best resolution we could get on the camera. And you're up at 13,800 feet. There's not as much atmosphere up there to jiggle around and cause problems. So it's a wonderful place to do the observations. And we could see, these are negative images, that these particular objects were clearly not spherical. They looked bipolar like the ones that we saw. And about another dozen we could tell were not spherical, but we couldn't make out the shapes of these. Okay, so this is tantalizing, but we'd like to know more about it. And this makes a good case to get time on the Hubble Space Telescope, because we've done the best we can from the Earth. So we put in a proposal to use the Space Telescope. But one thing about it, and of course I hadn't appreciated it, I mean, I thought this was tremendous to get these images on the left and then getting Hubble time. But it's such a jump in the resolution. The images are 10 times sharper. The resolution's 10 times greater. So you see so much detail. Here's the image. I rotated these. This is the one up. This is this object. And this is this one. I told my wife, it was like I've been walking around without my glasses. You know, the put them on and things are so sharp. I mean, it is amazing. Someone talked about naming. We said, I've got to put names on these. I mean, this one we called the Silkworm Nebula. This one, each half of it looked like cotton candy. So we called this a cotton candy nebula. Okay, that's fine. Walnut Nebula, Water Lily, and you see these names. But at any rate, beautiful images and opportunity to study. And we saw a lot of them had this bipolar shape. And so why would a shape like that occur? One model that's suggested is that if you have a torus around it, while it's still the red giant, when it's losing then the outer layers as the star becomes unstable and pushes off the gas, then it would come out through the hole like of a donut. And indeed, we found one object like that with the Hubble Space Telescope where you can actually see what looks like the torus around it. Now, where's the torus come from? If time permits, I'll come back to that. The other thing that I've been involved in, particularly more recently, was a project we started back in the early 90s. The question, do they vary in light? Things can vary in light because they could have a binary, it can ping and it passes in front of them, or they could pulsate. And I've been studying binary, so that seemed like a neat thing to see if these have binary stars in the center. And this is a project that we could do at Valparaiso University because the telescope was accessible for us every clear night. Now, it doesn't mean we have a lot of clear nights, but I mean, we have enough that we could do with CCD cameras that we could study when there are faint clouds because we studied our object relative to some ones nearby so we could observe through clouds, thin clouds. But it's one that we can involve students with. And you had every night was ours. I mean, a telescope in Hawaii, we get three nights, maybe twice a year, and we're fortunate. Not a way to do a monitoring project. So we began this project. There was one other group that's continued doing some, a Russian group, but not with as many objects, and I sort of had the list of them to start with, so that was an advantage for us. And a lot of students have been involved over the years in this project. So we've been observing 25 years, which is a nice timeline for us. And I just want to take a look at one of these. On this graph is a measure of the relative brightness, and this is versus time. And you can't read this, but here's 1994, 95, 96, 97, 98. So we're observing in those seasons because you can't observe year-round because some of the stars are only they're up during the day part of the year, so we can follow them. And these are in magnitude systems that astronomers use. But from here to here is about a factor of 1/10 in brightness, 10% change in brightness from here to here. So we're looking at 20% changes in brightness, not large amounts. This one's a little bit more. This is 40% from here to here. Let me just walk through this. This is with a V filter as a visual filter. This was with a red filter. And this was measuring effectively the change in color of the star. So we could see it get fainter, brighter, and so forth. First season, second season. But notice, and this is a more extreme example, you see a nice change, a cyclical change in brightness. The next year you see it with the same pupil, but the amplitude's much smaller. And so we see a changing amplitude. I knew this was not going to be just a two-year project because to unravel that, whether the amplitude's changing or it looks a bit like a beat phenomenon, like you might have two periods close by each other. Then we also got radial velocity. I won't go through the details of this, but the radial velocity had the same period, and it showed us effectively they were pulsating. So we determined that these stars, not evidence for binarity, but for pulsation, with periods on the order of 100 days. Now this was many years of observing. This is some of the early ones. We put the data through a Fourier transform program that determines, pulls out a period in it, and this shows over folding all the cycles together, what it looks like. Other ones that we've continued with multiple, these are fitted with two periods. So there are some 30 stars that we've been getting the periods of at Valparaiso University. The other thing, we have not just the brightness variations and color variations, but also the radial velocity, and we observe these contemporaneously. And if we plot them all with the same period, we find that when they're brightest, they're bluest or hottest, and they're smallest in size. And that tells us something about the mechanism of the pulsation and what drives it. And there's data now coming available from all sky surveys with telescopes. But, what are we learning from this? Pulsation. Going to move on. We found that those that had the lowest temperatures have the longest pulsation periods, and those with the somewhat higher temperatures, is only a range of 3,000 degrees, pulsate with shorter periods. and I had the sense of that, but not that it was such a linear. What we can make some larger deductions from this. Well, these are a dozen different stars. We know that the stars get hotter with time as they evolve. So this, in a sense, these lines would represent the average evolution of a single star if we could watch it over time evolving over that several hundred years. So the star, with time, the period of pulsation decreases. This shows the amplitude. Again, the cool ones pulsate with big amplitude and these with small amplitude. So over time, the pulsation dies down, which is consistent with the pulsation theory. I'm going to skip some things in the interest of time. But taking the models, which predict how the temperature of the star should change with time as it evolves to become hotter, and we show how the period changes with temperature, one could see that the period ought to change with time in a way that we could measure, actually. Based on the slope of our relationship, it looks like the period should change by about one day in 20 years and get shorter, which is quite exciting to think that we might be able to measure, you know, the real evolution of stars in time, because this is such a relatively short-lived phase. So attempting to do that, I divided the data into time and interval. The bottom line is it's messy because the stars have multiple periods. And if they had just one period that beat like a clock or a pendulum, one might be able to do this. And I still haven't given up on this because this would be a tight constraint on these evolutionary models. I took the data and divided it into 5-year time intervals and normalized it for the stars. So this says that this star started with a certain period, that it increased by 4%, and then another 1%. And this shows that it decreased over time by about 1%. And it's 1% level that we're trying to measure. So that's pretty hard to do. We also look for variability in the velocities. I'm going to skip over all that and just come to my conclusions here. In this topic of science's understanding creation, you know, privileged to be able to be involved in bringing to light the properties of stars in a previously unstudied phase in their evolution, to learn about their properties and how they fit in with the stars that come before them and after them. We've learned about their pulsation properties. We've also learned about the shape of the nebulae, and the study of the velocity said, you know, I told you that there's this evidence for a torus around the star. The most likely explanation is because as the star lost gas, its companion gravitationally focused it to the plane, and then a torus formed. But we don't find evidence for the binary companion. Still looking at some of this, and the project involves students at a really fundamental level. And hopefully it's impacted them in a positive way by our common life together in the summers as we work or being at the observatory in ways that will be good for them. So it's been, like many of you who are scientists, it's a privilege that we have to study God's universe.
Thank you, Bruce.
Thank you.
Time for one question. If you look at the defined neighborhood of space at the stars, do any patterns emerge in terms of their state of evolution?
Well, there are places, like in gas clouds, where we see what seem to be stars forming. And the idea is, well, they're forming together out of a cloud of gas, and the ones that form first heat the gas and cause it to glow and bring our attention to it. And then there are clusters of stars which seem to be in the different stages of this evolution depending upon their initial mass. Because the higher the mass, the faster they fuse their elements, and so they evolve more quickly. So we do see stars at certain places in different phases. You know, these are young stars, these are older stars. But in the solar neighborhood, you know, there's a mixture of stars.
Okay.
Hey, I'm sorry I went so long, and I don't mean to cut down questions, but I'll add it.
To see if I understand this. As the star loses gas, the remaining gas you see is hotter. Is that why the temperature is going up?
Well, the star doesn't lose mass till right at the end when it becomes this big giant star. It becomes unstable.
No, I see you measure 5,000 and 6,000 up to 8,000. Why is it getting hotter there?
Yes, because the hot core of the star has this thin envelope and it's fusing the at the base of that. It's revealing more and more of the hot core is being seen. It has an atmosphere, a cooler atmosphere over it.
You're talking, but the actual core is much, much hotter.
We're not seeing the core that has a temperature of, what would the temperature of the core be? 20 million degrees, 30, 50 million
much,
degrees.
Much higher. Yeah, and how many of your students went into astronomy?
Into the master's level, maybe a dozen.
Really?
And for many of our students, it served as an entry point. Mm. And they went on and they did nuclear physics or other kinds of physics. But this was a good entry point because they didn't need quantum mechanics or something. So many of them went on to graduate schools and PhDs in other areas of physics.
Thank you very much.